First case this morning is case number 64913, State of Nevada versus Marion Harris. Ms. Renetti for the appellant and Mr. Coffey for the respondent. Ms. Renetti, would you like to save some reply time?
Yes, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes.
Okay, I'll try to watch it for you.
Please, the Honorable Court and Counsel, my name is Dina Renetti, and I'm representing the appellant in this matter. The trial court in this case erred by granting the respondent's motion for new trial in a case involving the brutal death of a 14-month-old child by the name of Deion Johnson. One of the bases for the trial court's granting of the respondent's motion for new trial was that the state of Nevada improperly commented on the defendant's Fifth and Sixth Amendment right in a pre-Miranda, pre-custodial setting. The court erred. First and foremost, there was no silence, but rather conduct, as outlined in this court's decision in Salinas v. State, 104 Nevada 699, the 1988 decision. And in that case, the prosecution referred to the defendant's failure to report for 2 police interviews, and ultimately that defendant fled to Mexico. This honorable court held that it wasn't even convinced that the prosecution commented on silence. Rather, the defendant was anything but silent, quote. Rather, the prosecutor's references to the abortive meetings were specific examples of the defendant's conduct. And ultimately, this court held that what the prosecution did was proper in this in that case. Similarly, in this case, we did not comment on silence, but rather the defendant's affirmative actions of contacting police, setting up police interviews, and then failing to do so. But even if this court considers her reluctance or her unwillingness to come and speak to police officers in subsequent interviews, and you believe that is silent, even with the pre-Miranda, pre-arrest silence, we were able to comment. And what is most important is looking at the United States Supreme Court Salinas v. Texas from 2013, which is directly on point in this particular matter. In that case, the defendant in pre-Miranda, pre-custodial setting, voluntarily came in for an interview, answered questions, and at some point during the interview remained silent when police officers started to question about ballistics and whether or not that defendant's shotgun would match the shell casings found at the crime scene. The United States Supreme Court said in a plurality decision that the government was allowed to comment on the defendant's silence in that pre-custodial, pre-Miranda setting. In fact, Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas go even one step further in their analysis in the concurring opinion by stating that, in fact, they don't believe the Fifth Amendment privilege even applies in any setting other than a custodial setting. But the law of the case through the plurality decision is unless there is an unequivocal waiver or invocation right to remain silent, the state, the government, is allowed to comment. And that is exactly what the state of Nevada did in this case. The trial court erred by ignoring that in its decision and ignoring the Ninth Circuit, as well as the Fifth Circuit, Eighth Circuit, and Eleventh Circuit opinions. Rather, the trial court relied on 3 different states, Washington, Ohio, and the Court of Appeals in Maryland. And I'd like to bring your attention that the court specifically referenced State v. Easter. It's a Washington case from 1996. It has been overruled.
Excuse me, Ms. Renetti. Yes. Is there a marked difference, well, first of all, between Salinas, where somebody's answering questions and then they opt not to answer certain questions? So commenting on the silence in that regard, is that different than somebody who doesn't participate in the interview, especially under the circumstances that we have here, where there's a call from an attorney, at least some specter of an attorney being involved? What inference did you want the jury to draw from the failure to participate in a voluntary police interview?
It all goes to flight. Justices, it goes to flight, and at the end of the day, in the defense opening statements, they drew a compare and contrast method with the defendant in this case, Marion Harris, and her boyfriend, Armani Foster, in pointing the finger at Armani Foster, that we placed a bet on Marion Harris and then ignore the evidence against Armani Foster. And that's for those reasons we did what we did. Okay. And I believe in Salinas, I believe that the analysis of whether or not you show up to an interview or not is really inconsequential from the United States Supreme Court. Unless there is an unambiguous invocation of a right to remain silent, the Supreme Court has said the comment on silence, whether it's to show up to an interview, not show up to the interview, I believe is permissible under the United States Supreme Court.
Ms. Renetti, I had a question just to follow up on Justice Stiglitz's question here under these circumstances. Here the trial court's heard all the evidence. They've heard the flight issue, heard the arguments, everything. The trial court, who almost never grants new trials, never. You know, it's in criminal cases. I can't remember the last time this happened in a criminal case. So here the trial court heard all this, analyzed it, is on the scene as a fact finder, is considering all this, and we're not fact finders. And you're asking us to second guess her on how she interpreted the facts. So why shouldn't we defer to the trial court judge and her decision after hearing all the evidence and all
that? Actually, what it is not only a failure to factually analyze, but the trial court failed to properly analyze the correct case law. The trial court erroneously relied on Ohio, Washington, and Maryland, and in fact, quoted the Washington court. Since that court opinion, 16 days ago, the Washington courts have overruled that case. That case, and just for a citation, is State v. Magna. It's a 2016 Washington appeal, Lexus 3045. The court found that the rule from Salinas is that absent an express invocation of the right to silence, the Fifth Amendment is not an obstacle to the state's introduction of a suspect's pre-arrest silence as evidence of guilt. Accordingly, after Salinas, the Fifth Amendment analysis for in Easter is no longer good law. Factually, Mr. Magnina was not arrested, under arrest, or any sort of police custody. His scheduled interview was voluntary. To the extent his failure to appear for the interview was relevant, the state was entitled to present this evidence. And that goes directly to your question regarding whether or not there is a difference, whether it's if someone appears for a police interview and elects not to answer certain questions or fails to appear at all. And that goes directly on point. That's the Washington case that overturns the case law that was erroneously relied upon by the trial court in our case.
So you're suggesting that the reason for commenting on this has to do with flight?
Correct.
Yeah. But didn't the trial court judge tell you weren't going to get the flight instruction and not talk about flight? Why did the state proceed to, in effect, ignore the direction of the trial court and talk about flight?
Actually, the ruling didn't occur until several days into the trial itself. And opening statements, the state of Nevada didn't comment very much at all regarding flight. The only thing that the state mentioned in opening statement was you're going to hear from homicide detectives that they tried to re-interview the defendant and that she never showed up. She called 8 hours later, said she would reschedule for the next day, sure, no problem, wait for her, and she never shows up for the interview.
Was there any objection to that at all?
Absolutely not. In fact, I believe it was a strategic decision on the state, on the defense's part, in twofold. One, in looking at their opening statement, they include that the fact that the state of Nevada, the police department, the Metropolitan Police Department, failed to listen to Marion Harris, and we placed the bet on Marion Harris rather than focusing on Armani Foster. In the defense's opening statement, they said, quote, and that's out of Appellant Appendix 118. And a few days later, after she had been with her family discussing what's going on, it's obvious that the police are not listening to her. And so she stops cooperating, and her family contacts an attorney. It was a strategic decision on their part. Moreover, there was a break in the proceedings after the first witness. After the first witness, stay out of abundance of caution, asked the defendant, are you putting on a character defense? And in fact, Mr. Coffey said emphatically, that is what they were doing. They were going to go with the character defense. And in that case, then it becomes even more relevant whether or not she cooperated with police, which they're now going to proceed under a good character defense, which they did throughout the trial in examining the decedent's mother, the boyfriend Armani Foster, and even including their cross-examination of Detective Boucher and Detective Keisner. They went throughout the entire trial, and even at the very end, during their closing arguments, referred to her good character. I would note that I believe that the trial court erred in allowing improper character evidence of Armani Foster into the proceedings, that he was in fact a gang member, there was domestic violence, and so forth. That's Appendix 924. The state objected when Mr. Coffey asked the question to Armani Foster about his tattoos, because those tattoos were gang-related. I objected, and at the bench, the trial court said, anybody can object to anything, but to be the state of that and keep something out on the defendant, it could be error on me, the district court, without the valid motion in limine. It's different when a defense just pops up with stuff. You're not held to the same standard. It's a different standard. It's a different standard for the state. It just is. It's not fair, but it is what it is.
Let me ask you this, Nanya. Apologize for interrupting you, but going back to the fact this is a cumulative error case, and my understanding is that prior to opening statements, the district court judge actually granted your request to give a flight instruction. And that during your opening, that's when you made references to those interviews. At what point in the trial did the judge come back and say, no more talking about this, I'm not going to give the instruction?
I appreciate Justice pointing to that fact. It wasn't until the examination of Detective Boucher that the trial court indicated that that the state of Nevada was being disingenuous with its flight instruction. Up until then, the respondent in this case had never objected to it. And in fact, later
on... So that was a sua sponte determination without objection.
Correct. And then even further, the trial court said, well, I will only give a flight instruction if you can prove to me that she knew, Marion Harris knew there was an arrest warrant out for her. The trial court believed that was a pivotal or crucial fact in order for the state to get a flight instruction. And that is why we were going to call, and we did call the Child Protective Services worker, because 2 days prior to the CPS hearing, the defendant, Marion Harris, told that CPS worker that, in fact, she was not going to appear for the CPS hearing for fear of being arrested.
Now, that drew an objection, correct?
Correct. That evidence was never elicited.
Okay. But that was that the only objection from the defense?
From respondent? Correct. It wasn't until the court sua sponte started to object regarding flight that the respondent then started to object. There was no objections in.
And no motion in limine pretrial?
Correct. Not an opening statement, and especially not in the direct examination of Armani Foster when the state presented certain evidence regarding that flight. There was no objection whatsoever by the respondent in this case. It was not until the trial court intervened, sua sponte, that the respondent then started to object to any type of flight.
Mr. Rennie, you have about two minutes and 10 seconds. You want to reserve that?
May I? Thank you so much.
Mr. Coffey, or the respondent?
Thank you. And Justice Berger, just so the record's clear, there had not been approval of a flight instruction pretrial. The instructions had not been settled. Both parties had submitted instructions, and what had happened, there was a discussion during the first or second witness, and that discussion was, the state is saying flight here. I don't see flight. What I see is her going to California because she's locked out of her house, she's pregnant, she's got no place else to go. You're going to have to come with something else to get a flight instruction, but I'll let you argue it. The court does make the comment, I'll let you argue it. Now, I don't know exactly what it means in that context, and nobody explores it. It could be, I'll let you argue whether you're going to get the instruction, or it could be, I'll let you argue flight later. But as the case goes forward, it becomes clear that flight was not an issue in this case, and I think the district court is entitled to great deference, having sat through the trial, to its determination that this was not a case of flight. Marianne Harris stays at her home. She calls 911 and she stays at her home for hours. She waits for the police to interview her. She gives a full interview to the police. It lasts a couple of hours and she is locked out of the home. She has to go back to get necessities. She's locked out of her home. She travels to Apple Valley. and that is where her family lives. She tells the police she is in California, and she maintains contact with the police up until the point that she calls, and this is directly from the state's opposition to our motion for new trial. She says, I'm bringing Craig Mueller, my attorney, with me. That's the way the state's opposition describes it, so they know what's going on. When the police try to set a second interview, she's in California, she doesn't make the trip on the 14th. The evening of the 14th, she calls, she says, I'm bringing an attorney with me to the next interview. That is enough to put the state on notice and to put the detectives on notice that she's going to be relying on privilege of counsel and the Fifth Amendment. And in fact,
I'm having a problem because you're conflating the two issues. You're not separating them. The fact that she has possibly retained an attorney, but without anything else, we don't know. Do we?
Well, here's what we do know. The meeting is set for noon the next day. There is a text message that is on her phone that gives the cross streets at 8 o'clock that morning for the noon meeting for Mueller and for Hines, the attorney's office. And a few minutes before the time scheduled for that meeting, somebody calls and says she's not going to appear at the meeting. Now, the police report says Mueller calls at some point. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out who it is that calls a few minutes before noon.
Does he assert that his client is not going to?
He says that I will bring her in tomorrow if she retains me. She's not been retained yet. What the district court found was it was obvious that she was relying on privilege at that point. And you know, the Supreme Court cases dating back, our description, and perhaps most important here, you know, who else it was obvious was the detectives. Because when we talked to Detective Boucher, when we talked to him on cross-examination, do you know who Mueller and Hines are? Yes, I do. Is it common practice for attorneys, the first thing they tell their clients, and Justice Cherry knows done criminal defense, don't open your mouth without an attorney there. That's the first thing out of your mouth. Our description was, any attorney worth the gum on the bottom of the shoe is going to give that advice. Like the Supreme Court has said, any attorney worth the salt is going to give that advice. And the court said, that is obviously what happened here. We know it because she stops contacting the police. We also know it because the police stop trying to contact her. They take it as an indication of right.
But isn't that different? How do you square that with this court's holding in Santelinas, Detloff? And why did the district court resort to cases from Ohio and Washington? I mean, we have jurisprudence in this state that permits pre-arrest comment on pre-arrest silence. And in this case, I don't see anything in the district court's findings that shows that the defendant asserted or invoked her Fifth Amendment privilege.
It's directly in the order. There was a clear reliance on Fifth Amendment privilege. It was a clear invocation. It's in the district court's order. It's in the order and decision that there's an invocation.
There's a conclusion by the district court, but there's no finding that the defendant invoked.
Well, during the conversation in these mistrial motions where the state is advised, don't go into that.
Stated a different way, Mr. Coffey, it appears as though the district court has stated that the assertion of pre-arrest silence constitutes the invocation of the Fifth Amendment. Our jurisprudence does not say that.
I don't believe, with all due respect, Justice Hardesty, I don't believe that's what the district court said. Okay. I believe what they said is that the contact with counsel, and by the way, the contact with counsel is not unequivocal. I'm bringing an attorney with me next time. Now, if you look at the other cases that we cited, Ocotan, for example, out of the Second Circuit, which was decided post-Salinas, says in footnote 3 that first looking at this decision, we know no circuit that's come to a different conclusion that once there's been an invocation, it's appropriate to comment on that post-arrest silence. We know no circuit court that came to a different conclusion. And they said that that analysis would not change post-Salinas. Salinas is a very different situation. The Supreme Court specifically does not answer the question as to what happens when there's an invocation or notice. Now, it's important to look at what notice means. In Miranda, I want an attorney. I might want an attorney, may not be enough. But if you put the government on notice under Quinn, that is the standard, U.S. Supreme Court standard under Quinn, what you have to do is put them on notice that you are relying on the privilege.
when you say I'm bringing an attorney with me to the next meeting, the attorney calls and says, I will call you back, and the questioning stops, it's clear that the government is on notice. It was obvious to everyone in the courtroom that the government was on notice, that she was relying on the privilege, and that is all that is necessary to sustain the privilege, is that prove that she is relying on the privilege. And that's what Salinas says, in fact. Salinas fell silent mid-interview, and this is what Justice Stiglitz pointed out, it was mid-interview. What would you say if we knew there was some forensic testimony that came back to you and he clammed up and looked the other direction? A very different situation than somebody contacting an attorney, saying I'm bringing an attorney with me, and the police stopping the questioning. The problem that you've got here, of course, is you also put the defendant in an untenable position if you let this kind of practice go forward. Think about it in practical terms. You contact an attorney. You are advised of the right to remain silent.
That there's nothing in this finding that shows any advice by Mueller to this client.
There is a footnote, if you will look, in our motion for new trial. We actually contacted Mueller, and the state also had the opportunity to bring Mueller in for a hearing. The court offered that. Nobody took advantage of it. But there is a footnote in our motion for new trial. We did contact Mueller. He said his standard practice is to advise clients to contact him to remain silent.
That footnote does not reference this client at all.
It does not.
It deals with his standard practice.
It does. It does.
The operative sentence in the court's order says the actions by the prosecutors to use a compare and contrast method to show the defendant's consciousness of guilt by her decision to consult and follow the advice of a criminal defense attorney by invoking her right to remain silent during later investigation, during family court proceedings, and by staying with her family as she was pregnant and locked out by her residents were overly prejudicial to the defendant.
Correct.
The first problem I have on the issue of Fifth and Sixth Amendment questions, though, is where in this record is there any showing of any advice by a criminal defense attorney or that she even consulted him? Indeed, the record shows Mueller told him he wasn't retained.
Was not retained, but retention, again, I don't think is key under this case.
We don't even know from this record what took place between Mueller and Ms. Harris, if anything. And that's the fundamental ground under which the Fifth and Sixth Amendments are being asserted by using, and that's the real legal difference here, whether you look at the Ohio analysis or whether you look at our existing case law.
All due respect, I believe that we do circumstantially, and it's preponderance of the evidence is that she was given advice. You know that because, and if you look at the court's order, it mentions these things. It says she stops talking to police once Mueller comes into the picture. She continues to maintain contact with CPS, by the way. She also tells CPS that I did not go to a CPS hearing on the advice of counsel. The court relied upon all those things in finding circumstantial issues relying on advice of counsel. Could the record have been better? I suppose it may have, Justice Hardesty. I don't disagree with that. But if you look at a preponderance of the evidence standard, if you look at whether or not it was air for the court to come to this conclusion with what it had in front of it, I do not believe it was.
In the absence of an objection, don't we evaluate this on plain air?
I don't believe so. And here is why. First off, it was noticed by the court sua sponte. This court has taken liberty to notice constitutional errors sua sponte itself in the Coleman case, for example. In addition to that, you have to understand how this works in practice in this situation.
But there could be a strategic reason to have allowed this to go forward as it went. I mean, I'm very concerned with the point on plain error that Justice Hardesty is raising.
There was not a strategic reason. She didn't appear for the interviews, and she didn't give later interviews, and that was going to be
right,
obvious.
Right, but you allowed the state to make its opening and to allude to this.
And that was factually true. There was nothing that we could do to get around that. The problem came from hammering. Armani showed up to an interview, she did not. Armani cooperated with the police, she did not. Armani stayed in town, she did not. Armani did this, she did not. It's a constant inference that there is guilt because she exercised her constitutional right to remain silent. That's the problem, that's the fundamental problem with what we've got.
You have to timely assert the privilege to preserve it.
She did, I believe, by saying she contacted an attorney and having Mueller call on her behalf. That was when the invocation took place or when she asserted the privilege.
But also in trial.
Well, with all due respect, Judge, in trial, As soon as it became obvious, we asked for a mistrial. I'm not sure what else we can do. As soon as it became obvious what the state was doing, when we started to bring out the facts to contact an attorney, we made that, we were driven to that decision, I think, by what the state had done up to that point. We asked for a mistrial. In no uncertain terms, I think that preserved the record for the review. And after that, the court told the state, in no uncertain terms, don't go there again. The state then put this CPS worker on the stand for what the court concludes is no purpose other than to say that Marianne didn't show up. And that one we know exactly, she said,
the counsel, was there any testimony from that CPS worker that was allowed in that goes to that point? There was a bench conference, which was not, sure was not made aware of, but that was cut off before anything theoretically was damaging.
I tend to disagree with that.
Explain to me why you would disagree.
Because up to that point, we have, including a jury question with Armelani Foster, did you say that she appeared at the hearing with you?
What did the CPS worker testify to that you see as harmful?
The CPS worker was asked directly and emphasized that there was a CPS hearing and that Marianne Harris was advised of the date of the CPS hearing.
And you objected, right?
But that was in front of the bench.
And you objected. No answer was given. Is that correct?
No, that was answered. That was answered. Whether or not she appeared in front of, whether or not she was given the date was answered. It was the next question where the objection came in.
And she didn't testify as anything that Ms. Harris stated?
No. But again, in the whole context of the trial, it is apparent what is going on and the clear inference, you know, I don't think it's appropriate for the state to do indirectly what they can't do directly. And the clear inference from this whole thing is that Harris is guilty because she didn't go to a CPS hearing. Harris is guilty because she didn't want to interview with the police. That can't be the rule. Think about it from a criminal defense attorney's perspective. When I give advice to a client, I tell them not to speak to the police, and I do it on the assumption that that silence is not going to be used against them at a later date. What am I to tell them if you can't invoke the right to remain silent, the right to consult counsel in a pre-arrest setting? Because whatever they do, they're going to lose.
Salinas, if they say, I don't want to talk to you and I'm invoking my privilege, that's the end of it, right?
Salinas says we...
The three judges that...
Yes, correct. Salinas says we specifically don't reach that issue, but that is the way I read Salinas, too. I think that's where the court's going. The federal circuits have tended to go that way. The state decision, but the Supreme Court hasn't definitively said that. But, yes, I think that's where it's going.
That brings me to the problem with whether plain error applies, because if plain error applies, these are arguments that are close legally, and under Gaxiola, for error to be plain, it has to be as plain as a nose on your face.
Well, with all due respect, plain error, I believe, is an appellate standard and not a district court standard.
Okay, fair enough.
For good reason. The district court sits through the trial and hears the testimony. They see the effect on the jury. They saw the jurors were crying. They noticed the questions that were asked. They're familiar with the record in a way this court can never be as learned as this court is. So it's a different situation. I don't think hamstringing the district court with plain error is appropriate, particularly where the court noticed the error during the trial and tried to correct it, which is what happened here.
Thank you, Mr. Coffey. Mr. Nettie, rebuttal. We have a little over 2 minutes.
I wanted to address 2 points that were raised by counsel by this court, and one being the invocation. Mr. Coffey just mentioned that her stating that she was consulting an attorney is somehow an invocation of her right to remain silent. That flies in the face of this court's court rulings as well as the United States Supreme Court cases, both in Roberts v. State, which is a 1980 case, where the U.S. Supreme Court held that defendant does not invoke the privilege simply by remaining silent. Burgess v. Thompson, 2010, same thing. There must be an unambiguous invocation of the right to remain silent. Merely remaining silent is not an invocation.
Ms. Renee, yes. I'm sorry. Let's take it out of invocation analysis. Just bare relevance. Would you suggest to the court that if somebody decides not to participate in a voluntary police interview, will you come interview? No, thank you. That in and of itself is sufficient to allow the state to ask the jury to infer consciousness of guilt in flight and instruct them on same?
Twofold. One being that this defendant didn't just fail to cooperate, she actually agreed to cooperate and then failed to do so, which is exactly the same situation we have in Santolinas that this court ruled where in that case the defendant aborted two police interviews and then fled the jurisdiction. That's exactly what we have in this case. Defendant Marion Harris scheduled two meetings, aborted both those meetings, and went to California. I take issue with counsel's representation that there was no flight that was found. This court will notice that in the trial transcript, in fact, the trial court actually would not allow the state to make its record regarding flight. It happened twice, once during the examination of Detective Boucher, and also the following day in the morning, myself, I actually started reading the stuff into the record, and the court said that at a later time I could make my record. But there was absolutely a plethora of different facts to corroborate a flight instruction that the state was unable to present.
Thank you, Ms. Rudetti. Thank you, Mr. Coffey, for your spirited arguments and briefs in this matter.